This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross, who's off this week. We're speaking with Tara Westover, whose new book is about growing up with fundamentalist parents in rural Idaho. As a kid, she didn't have a birth certificate, never saw a doctor, and didn't go to school. She eventually made her way to college and earned a PhD at Cambridge. Her memoir is called Educated. Your family was Mormon, and you grew up with some pretty clear understanding of gender roles. I'm wondering what, you know, as you were a kid and then as you got a little older, did you have a vision for the kind of life that you would lead?
Well, my family was, I think, a bit more radical than most Mormons, especially on the question of gender. So in my mind growing up, there wasn't ever any question of what my future would look like. I would get married when I was 17 or 18. And I would be given some corner of the farm, and my husband would put a house on it, and we would have kids, and possibly I would become a midwife like my mother and take over with the herbs. When I was a child, this was very much the path as it was laid out for me, and music became very important to that, because music became something I wanted to learn how to do. And the first time that I had heard something like opera or a choir, I realized this is something that takes discipline, and you have to go somewhere and learn how to do this, and that there are people in the world who know about this and can teach this to you. And so I think it was really a draw of music that first made me think maybe it would be all right if I went away and went to a university, which my father was against, but maybe it would be all right because the reason I would go is to learn about music, and then I could come back and live on the farm and be a voice teacher or direct the church choir. And so in my mind, that was acceptable. I could do that.
Did you rebel at the thought of getting married and getting a house on the corner of the farm? Did it feel constricted?
Eventually, I suppose I did, but initially, no. I think initially my rebellion of going to college when my dad would have liked me to stay home and work in the herbs, I think that it was a pretty mild rebellion in the sense that I thought, well, I'm gonna go learn how to be a music teacher so that I can come home and do choir. It was a pretty tame rebellion. I was in school for probably 3 or 4 years before I began taking courses in history and political science, and I just started to realize how big the world was. I mean, when I arrived in college, I didn't know anything. One of my first lectures, I raised my hand and asked what the Holocaust was because I had never heard of it. And a year or two of being in this environment and learning about all of these things, the Holocaust, the civil rights movement, the 39th parallel, the difference between North and South Korea, the world started to feel very big. And that's, I think, when I began to wonder if moving back, if that was really what I wanted.
You know, there's another thing about moving into the mainstream world. I mean, you lived in a rural community where people worked hard all day and working in a scrapyard. I mean, I've done industrial work and I know what it's like to get that dirty. I mean, I'm wondering if your kind of habits of personal hygiene weren't exactly consistent with the mainstream world.
Yeah, and I think some of that might have been the fact that I had worked construction, but I think some of it was just my family. You know, my dad used to tease my grandmother, my mother's mother, because she would say, oh, don't you teach your kids to wash their hands after they go to the bathroom? And my father would say, no, I teach them not to piss on their hands. And that was just his idea of hygiene. And of course, when I went to the university and carried on with this, my roommates were pretty horrified, and I had to be, you know, they sat me down and sort of said, this doesn't cut it. You need to do this differently.
You had one of your brothers, Sean, had a violent streak. You had several incidents where he attacked you. Do you want to just explain a little bit what would happen and what triggered it?
Well, I'd said that my childhood had a lot of beautiful elements, but that there was this kind of duality to everything. And I think my brother Sean is a really great example of that in a way, because he was 10 years older than I was. He was my favorite of my brothers. And he and I were very close. He could be kind, he could be sensitive, he could be really loving. But he had another side. He could be manipulative, even cruel. And he would become violent. He would grab my wrist and twist it behind my back until it started to sprain, or sometimes he would grab me by my hair and haul me down the hallway and shove my head in the toilet and call me a whore. So this was the kind of interaction that I had with him, and it was, again, just this duality where sometimes he was so kind, and then other times he was just very cruel and quite dominating.
You know, the thing about, as I hear about this, I mean, it became an issue later in the family. You had a sister who had suffered some violence at Sean's hands, and your parents just wouldn't deal with it. And it's clear, as you describe these incidents, that they had seen some of this. And, you know, if you have parents who won't keep you safe, that just has to be a really damaging thing to go through. Did you feel that?
Well, I said I think all abuse is foremost an assault on the mind. And I think what's interesting about what happened with my parents, you know, the night that I talked to them, that I confronted them about my brother, my sister had asked me to, and I agreed that I should. So I confronted them, and I really believed that we could just put a stop to it and forgive it and ultimately probably forget it. But what happened was my parents didn't, I don't know if they didn't believe me, but they certainly said they didn't believe me. And so my father said I was lying. He said I was trying to destroy the family. My mother said possibly I was insane and my memories couldn't be trusted. And it was pretty terrible having my parents not believe me. But that wasn't the worst thing. The worst thing was that they told my brother immediately. My father called my brother Sean and told him what I'd said. And what followed then was a period of a lot of threats and menace from him, where he would call and threaten me or say that he was going to hire an assassin to come kill me. And ultimately, he then cut me out of his life and disowned me. And my parents supported that decision on his part. So getting back to that thing of, I think, abuse, in order for abuse to happen, reality has to be distorted in some pretty serious ways. And I think my parents made the decision to join in that distortion, I think, rather than correct it. And I don't know if they realized at the time the path that they were starting out on. Maybe it didn't seem that different to them, whether they believed me or didn't believe me, but it ended up having some pretty serious consequences.
The book tells the story of you, you know, going to Brigham Young University and then eventually to Cambridge in England and then to Harvard and getting a PhD and struggling with the poor self-image you had. And it's an amazing story. And there's a moment when you're at Harvard and your father comes with your mother and stays in your dorm room and wants to save you. He wants to give you a priesthood blessing to cleanse you of the thoughts and demons that have corrupted your life. And you write that you felt this impulse to give in, right? To just, yes, I'll accept the blessing, I'll return to this. Describe that impulse. I mean, this was that you'd spent a long time in a different world.
Well, I think I said the first stage of estrangement from my family was really involuntary. My brother had cut me out of his life, and my parents had accepted that, and they had kind of disinvited me from coming home that Christmas because they said it would make my brother uncomfortable. And then about 10 months later, I had this 10 months where I was ostracized from my family, not of my own choice. My parents announced that they were coming to Harvard, and that was surprising for a couple of reasons. There are two things my father hates more than anything. One is travel, and the other is liberals. So coming to Harvard was a surprise. And I think they'd only been there a very short time, my father and my mother, before I realized why they had come. And that is, they had come to offer me a way back into the family. That is to say, he'd come to offer me this blessing that I think he wanted to treat as a kind of exorcism of the demon that he believed was inside me that had made me say what I'd said about my brother. And there was a long period where I thought maybe I could do that. I could just allow the ritual to take place and I could blame the demon. All I had to do was exchange their memories for mine and I could have my family. So there was this period of a couple days, several days, when I was walking around Boston sightseeing with my parents that I thought this was a bargain I could make. And I was arguing with myself that maybe it was the right thing. I was trying to convince myself that there would be some dignity in denying my memories in order to win the love of my parents.
And in the end, you couldn't do it.
In the end, I couldn't do it. The night before my parents were supposed to return back to Idaho, my father offered me this blessing, and I tried to accept it. I really wanted to accept it. But in that moment, I think I understood something important, which was that the daughter that my father had come to reclaim no longer existed. She had studied and she had read and she had grown her own mind, and that mind had no tolerance for violence, and she could not give way to it. And I think it was in that moment I realized, of course it wasn't a demon that had said those things about my brother. I had said those things. And what my father had come, you know, to cast out of me, it wasn't a demon, it was me.
It's got to be a scary thing to write about your members of your own family. And I'm sure you've thought about how your parents will react. And it occurred to me that if in reading this, they see your life as you experienced and examined it, they'll get it in a way that they couldn't before, and it might lead to some sort of breakthrough. What do you think?
I hoped that when I was writing it. I don't know if that will happen. And I think I will always be watching for signs that my family culture has changed, that it's moved away from this place of secrecy and enabling. So I watch for those signs, but I don't wait for them. I've come to accept that whether or not my family changes is outside of my power. And I just try to live a full life either way.
Tara Westover, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Tara Westover's memoir is called Educated. BBC America will soon present the finale of Blue Planet 2, its latest nature documentary series presented by Sir David Attenborough. On March 6th, the series will be released in its entirety on home video. And our TV critic David Biancooley says wherever you can find it and see it, you should. Here's his review.
Blue Planet 2 already was shown in the UK and is now nearing the end of its run in the States on the BBC America network. It's a dazzling piece of television. And if you haven't been watching, you still can. All its episodes to date are currently available free on demand to cable or satellite subscribers who have access to BBC America. And on March 6th, 3 days after the series finale is shown on TV, the entire series is released on DVD, Blu-ray, and the even newer, more visually opulent format known as 4K Ultra HD. Yes, technology and TV formats keep advancing. And that's true on the filmmaking side as well. Blue Planet 2 is a sequel to a program that was filmed 17 years ago. But now, scientists and filmmakers are capturing images in unprecedented, truly breathtaking ways. With both robotic and manned submersibles, they go deeper into the oceans than any filmmakers before them, and find astounding evidence of life that looks as alien as any creature from a science fiction fantasy film. They fly drones with cameras over vast ocean spaces, capturing whale migrations for the first time. They even temporarily attach cameras to shark fins and to albatrosses to find out where they go and what they do when we're not looking. In the case of the albatross, it's a literal bird's eye view. And somehow, watching all this behavior of all these amazing creatures makes me treasure not only the planet on which we live, but the state-of-the-art TV which delivers such wonders to our high-def flat-screen televisions. And to me, one of the most amazing creatures of all in Blue Planet 2 is its human host and narrator, Sir David Attenborough. He's been making nature programs for TV since he hosted Zoo Quest in England in 1954. That's almost 65 years traveling around the globe, witnessing the wonders and the evolution of nature. He's now 91 and still approaches his job the same way. He speaks in a whisper that's almost conspiratorial, as if reciting a bedtime story to a grandchild. And he writes his narration so simply that children can watch and should. In the U.S., we first got a major taste of Attenborough's magic in the 1979 nature series Life on Earth. But since then, as some combination of writer, producer, and narrator, he's turned out documentary miniseries at a Ken Burns pace and of similar quality. The Living Planet, The Trials of Life, Life of Birds, Planet Earth, and now two editions of The Blue Planet. I recommend them all. Increasingly, and with benefit of firsthand experience and evidence, Attenborough in his TV programs has sounded the alarms about rising ocean temperatures, melting polar ice caps, pollution, and overfishing. But in Blue Planet 2, he adds a hopeful note that's both surprising and reassuring. When a marine guide in Sri Lanka hears local fishermen telling tales of sperm whales gathering in large numbers offshore, that guide spends 3 years trying to find the whales. And when he does, Blue Planet 2 crews are there to record the spouting, the underwater clicking sounds of whale communication, and the sight of whales swimming literally by the hundreds.
Sperm whales were once killed in vast numbers, and it's thought that if the slaughter had continued, the species would be in danger of extermination. But now, here at least, they are being seen in huge numbers.
The final episode of Blue Planet 2 spends time with the scientists and activists who work hard to protect various species and to warn of specific dangers. Like plastics, which, when improperly disposed of, can seep into the food chain even at the microscopic level, poisoning the milk of mother dolphins and killing birds and fish who either ingest or get caught in floating clumps of plastic garbage. Water levels and temperatures are rising, coral reefs are bleaching and dying, but Attenborough, a living witness to it all, still finds the beauty of nature across the globe and still finds hope.
We are at a unique stage in our history. Never before have we had such an awareness of what we are doing to the planet. And never before have we had the power to do something about that. Surely we have a responsibility to care for our blue planet. The future of humanity, and indeed all life on Earth, now depends on us.
David Attenborough not only finds and photographs and champions our planet's natural treasures, he's one of them.
David Biancooley is editor of the website TV Worth Watching. His latest book is The Platinum Age of Television, From I Love Lucy to The Walking Dead, How TV Became Terrific. Our next guest, Richard Jenkins, has earned his second Academy Award nomination for his supporting role in director Guillermo del Toro's The Shape of Water, which earned 13 Oscar nominations, just one shy of the record. Jenkins has appeared in more than 50 films, including Flirting with Disaster, Step Brothers, Burn After Reading, and The Visitor, which earned him an Oscar nomination for Best Actor. He also had memorable roles in the TV series 6 Feet Under and the HBO miniseries Olive Kittredge. The Shape of Water is a modern fable about a mysterious aquatic man-like creature held in a tank at a secret government facility in the Cold War. A mute cleaning woman, played by Sally Hawkins, develops a relationship with the creature and dreams of smuggling him out of the building he's kept in. Jenkins plays her neighbor, Giles, who's drawn into her plan to liberate the creature. Well, Richard Jenkins, welcome back to Fresh Air. Congratulations on the film and the Oscar nomination.
Thank you.
Just describe your character, Giles, will you?
Giles is, it takes place in 1962, and he's, I don't know, he's about 70 years old. I don't know how that happened. And he's an artist, he's an illustrator working for an ad company, but he's lost his job because photographs are becoming popular at that time. So he's working on a piece that he thinks might get him back in the business, and he's gay and is secretly gay, as everyone was in 1962. And, you know, it's a time of crisis in his life. And he's best friends to Eliza, played by Sally Hawkins, who is the lead in the movie. And she lives next door to him in an apartment, and she comes over. She's mute. He understands her sign language. They have been friends for a long time. And he plays musicals on TV, old Hollywood musicals that he loves, and he tells her about them, and she loves them too. And they have this bond, this friendship. She takes care of him. She gives him a sandwich and some eggs every night before she goes to work. And he feels like he's the mentor and she's the student, and we come to find out it's the other way around.
Yeah, she works the night shift at a government facility where this aquatic creature has been captured and is being held and abused, and she hatches a plan to rescue him by smuggling him out. And I want to play a scene where she has come to ask you to help her in smuggling this creature out of this top-secret government facility. She's practically frantic with desire to get this done. You are reluctant because you're involved in your own things. You're an illustrator, and you have a big meeting that day that you think will be important to you, so you're reluctant to do this. The thing that's interesting about what we're going to hear is that it's a dialogue between two people. You're the only one who speaks because she is mute. And what we'll hear is you reacting to what she is signing. And then there comes a point in the scene where she wants you to say aloud what she is signing, and you agree to do that. And then we hear her signing, and we hear her in your voice explaining her relationship with this creature with whom she's struck this deeply emotional bond. So it's an interesting scene. Let's listen. So this is Sally Hawkins and Richard Jenkins, and Richard Jenkins' character Giles speaks first, responding to this idea of getting the creature out of this facility.
Get him out? What are you talking about? No, absolutely not. Because it's breaking the law, that's what. Probably breaking the law just talking about it. Oh, he's alone. Oh. Now, does this mean that whenever we go to a Chinese restaurant, you want to save every fish in the tank? So what if he's alone? We're all alone. The loneliest thing you've ever seen. Well, you just said it, right? You just said it. You called it a thing. It's a thing. It's a freak. I can understand you. Calm down. God, calm down. All right, I will repeat it to you. What am I? I move my mouth like him. I make no sound like him. What does that make me? All that I am, all that I've ever been, brought me here to him. See, you're saying him. It's a him now. It's a... You just hit me. Oh, Eliza, let go of me.
And that's our guest Richard Jenkins in the film The Shape of Water. It's a powerful scene, and Sally Hawkins is just so magnificent in this role. You want to just tell us about shooting that scene?
Yeah, as I was listening to it, I'm thinking, we rehearsed that for 3 weeks, the two of us, on our own. And it was really interesting because it was a huge scene for the movie and for her and me. And she wanted to get the signing right. She wanted to not have to think about it. And I wanted to not get ahead of her or behind her. I wanted to know it too. But when we shot it, it was nothing like we had rehearsed it, and which was great. It was terrific. You heard me say, "You hit me." There's one moment in the scene where I look at my watch, which wasn't in the scene. I just looked at my watch because I wanted to get out of there, and she gave me a swat. She really smacked my hand. And so that's, you know, it just came alive that day. It was really fun.
I've read that when you go into a role, you try not to make too many decisions about how you're going to do a scene. You get ready and then let it happen?
I try to, yeah. It doesn't always work that way, but that's the goal, is to just be present, you know, and just whatever comes at you, deal with it.
Gosh, you know, it strikes me that it would take enormous confidence to do that. When I picture, like, there's a crew of, what, 40 people all being paid while they're waiting for you to get something that we can use, there must have been some point in your career where you realized that you could do that.
Well, there was a point in my career where I bored myself to death. I just was like, if this is it, if I got to stop doing this, because if I'm boring myself, God knows what the audience is thinking. you know, so you say, you know, what's that saying? You do what you do till you can't do it anymore, and then you do something else. And that's where I was as an actor. I couldn't keep doing what I was doing. So I knew better, but I just refused to, because it's scary. It's kind of scary just to let it go. You know, but you find that when it's working, that it's effortless and it's fun and it's joyous. And it's not like you stumble around for 20 takes. I mean, that's not, you have to know what it is you're saying, what you're talking about. You certainly thought about it a ton. But when it comes time to do it, you just try to let it go.
You know, some people, when they take on a role, like to know or invent a backstory for their character. And I read that Guillermo del Toro, I guess, gives everybody a backstory about their character and a secret. Did you get that for Giles, and did it help?
I did, yeah, yeah. He and he said, you can use it or not. And I he said, you're not going to use it, are you? I said, I don't think so. And after I lost the Golden Globe, he sent me an email and said, if you'd used the backstory, you might have won. I just feel that I don't want to make decisions like that. And if it's not in the script, if it's not in the text, it means it's not in the movie. And if it's not in the movie, it's not helpful to me. It's just, it's confusing. And, you know, but it's not that it isn't helpful. It's, you see Guillermo's mind and the way he was writing this character, but I don't make decisions like that. You know, that kind of stuff really isn't important to me.
Coming back to when you were talking about how there came a point when you were bored, can you take us back to that time? Do you remember when you felt bored, a role, what it felt like?
I don't remember the specific role, but I remember being outside of myself, looking at me doing what I was doing. That's the feeling I got. And I thought, you know, what am I doing? What's the point of this profession to me? I mean, is this what it means to me, just to do this thing night after night without feeling life? And I went back to an old acting coach I had. Harold Guskin was his name. He wasn't an old man. He was just a coach I had worked with for a year. And I went back to what he taught me. And I just said, okay, let's try this. And he basically said, quit trying to hide who you are. You're the only thing you have. And I just refused to believe that it was enough, that it was interesting enough, that I had anything to offer. But the thing you come to, that I came to, is that whether you think that or not, that's all you got. So you have to rely on that. Every experience has to come through a filter through your experience. You know, you get angry, it's you're getting angry. What makes you angry? So I was trying to copy others or be something else. It takes a long time to trust yourself enough to think that I have something to offer. And it's, I still don't believe it. I still think I don't. But you know, you know that the only chance you have is to just kind of live your life and exist on the screen.
You've described how, you know, some scripts that you just know are terrific. What kind of scripts don't work? What kind of scripts do you reject?
Well, sometimes I can read a great script, and I don't like the part, or I don't think I'm right for it. I mean, there are times I've read really great parts and think, there's so many other actors who could do this better than me. And I just say no to it. But I look for the writing. And when you read great dialogue, if you're an actor, it's just so, it's, you know it. You know it in page one. Hmm. You know, and that's when you start looking at the character and turning the pages and say, oh, please don't die. Please don't die.
Right.
And then you know you're in, you got something great. You know, it's not, you read it, if exposition, every movie has it, you know, but if you're talking to your brother and you say, you're my brother, and do you remember when our mom died last year, and she was sick, you know, with cancer, and do you remember our uncle came over and he shot Jimmy in the arm that day? It's like, does your brother have Alzheimer's? I mean, why are we having this conversation? You know, it's for the audience. It's like in movies where you talk to the audience 90% of the time, you kind of want to stay away from that stuff. But to write exposition brilliantly is hard. There are things the audience has to know about you, but how do they find that out? And that's when you see the skill of the writer. For me, that's what I look at. Sometimes it's a great subject matter that is not as interestingly done as you would like it to be. And then sometimes it's The Shape of Water, where you read it and go, holy mackerel.
Yeah. I want to play another clip from The Shape of Water. This is a moment where Eliza, your neighbor who works in this government facility, has managed to smuggle this aquatic creature out of this facility and save his life. He's kind of like a man, but kind of with aquatic features and fins and webbed feet and such. And he's in this huge bathtub. And this is a scene where you're sitting there while she's away, and you and this aquatic creature are kind of, you know, taking each other's measure. Let's listen.
Have you always been alone? Did you ever have someone? Do you know what happened to you? Do you? Because I don't. I don't know what happened to me.
I don't know.
I look in the mirror and the only thing that I recognize are these eyes. In this old man's face. You know, sometimes I think I was either born too early or too late for my life. Maybe we're both just relics.
And that's Richard Jenkins speaking with the aquatic creature in The Shape of Water. What's going on in this scene?
Well, he's projecting a little bit. You know, this. It's interesting. You know, here it is. He first says to her, "This in the first scene we played, you played, was he's a fish in a tank," and now he's talking to him like he's her fiance. You know, it's an unbelievable arc that's happened in a very short time. You know, he's seeing himself. You know, this lonely thing could be Giles. You know, and I think it's a beautiful scene. You know, we end up talking about ourselves when we do, you know, are you like me? Have you been alone your whole life? We're both out of place. We're both misfits, you know.
You grew up in the Midwest, DeKalb, Illinois, right? Studied theater in college and then went to Providence, Rhode Island to act in a repertory theater there where you spent a long time, right? 14 years.
14 seasons, yeah.
Yeah. Did you see yourself developing a career in regional theater, or did you want to get in movies?
I always wanted to be in movies since I can remember. I didn't see a play until I was maybe 14 or 15. I went to Chicago. My parents took me to see Bye Bye Birdie, and I couldn't believe there were kids like my age or a little older on stage. It was just incredible. But I grew up watching movies, and I said, how do you do that? That's what I want to do. So, but the theater was there, you know, that was accessible. And I auditioned and became an apprentice at Trinity Rep in Providence.
Right. And so while you were doing that, you eventually managed to get into movies. How did you get better? How did you get noticed? You weren't living in L.A. networking.
No. I went out to L.A. for a year, and it was just not a good time. It was not going to happen. So I came back, and I went back to the theater, and there was a man there named Adrian Hall who ran it, who really, you look back in your life, and you see people who just step in and say, I think you should be doing this. This is, you know, who give you just the kind of encouragement you need to keep just going a little bit longer. I had somebody in college named John Ficca did the same thing to me, and Adrian Hall, who I was terrified of for the first couple of years, and I don't think he ever knew my name for the first 2 years, but we ended up having a relationship where he trusted me and, you know, gave me responsibility, made me kind of live up to what I wanted to be. He demanded it of me, so that was an incredible time of growth and self-discovery.
An agent finally saw you at a performance in New Haven, right? And you started auditioning. Started in movies, well, I guess in your mid-30s, is that right?
Yeah, my mid-30s.
What would winning an Oscar mean to you?
Gosh, you know, the truth is, and I know this sounds weird, but you try not to think about it.
Yeah, I could see that.
There's so many great performances this year. Sam Rockwell, who's so fabulous mm-hmm. in Three Billboards, is, you know, he's the guy this year. And I mean, I get it. It's part of the deal. It's an amazing thing to have an Oscar in your house. Oh my gosh. I mean, incredible. To be nominated for these awards, it's humbling and it's beautiful. And, you know, to win one would be extraordinary. It would be extraordinary. But at the same time, I'm fairly realistic.
Well, Richard Jenkins, it's been great to have you back. Thanks much for speaking with us.
Well, thanks for having me.
Richard Jenkins has earned an Academy Award nomination for his supporting role in the film The Shape of Water. The awards presentation is March 4th. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Mooj Zaidi, Thea Challoner, and Seth Kelly. Our associate producer of digital media is Molly C.V. Nesper. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.